available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Dr. Mary Mackey, and she's the author of many novels and books of poetry, and the most recent is The Village of Bones, and it's a prequel to the Earth Song series, the first of which the book, The Year the Horses Came. And Mary, we were talking about the troubadour culture and talking about the oral tradition, and I was reminded of an interview we did years ago with Leonard Schlein, who wrote a book called The Alphabet and the Goddess, I think, is one of his books. And he said something that always stuck with me, that he said, when you pass something along orally, it has more accuracy than the written word. And I thought, wait a minute, how could that be? And then he started to explain how we can have many different interpretations, let's say, of the Bible, or many different interpretations of, we have lawyers that earn their whole living on just interpreting a contract. And we think because it's written down, that means we've got it all set in stone. But he was intimating that the oral tradition, we tend to understand the meaning of it with greater accuracy.
Well, we can also ask questions as it's communicated to us, and also you get the emotional feeling behind it that you don't get with something's written. We all know that when we send emails, that's what all those emojis are for, because if we don't have those, you can say something that's meant to be funny or ironic, and you can lose a friend because they don't know the emotional expression.
Oftentimes, if it's something complicated, I'll pick up the phone. I'll say, wait, this is getting too complicated. I'm going to have to talk to someone, you know, voice to voice, because it just gets...
misunderstanding.
Yeah. So
I actually once wrote a little essay to a group I was in called Email is Not Our Friend. And I said, we can't, you know, what's happening is some people feel left out. They get missed. Mistakes are made. People think it's intentional. And we need to talk to one another more often than we do.
Exactly. And then there's the eye contact that also is helpful, because if we have too many electronic filters, then we're losing something else.
Also,
there.
You can tell whether people are lying or not when you talk to them in person. You can, you can tell their level.
That.
Yeah, we can tell their level of reliability better.
Yeah, which is
very interesting.
Exactly. And then I was thinking also there is something that's kind of might be considered bringing the troubadour back, that culture back, and this is in podcasting. So a lot of people doing podcasts, which are going back to storytelling, and it has the problem is it has no filters. But the good thing about that is that everybody can be a publisher, and they can all.
Of course, what I'd like to see them do is take those stories to a big mead hall where everybody's sitting around with the dogs on the floor and the rushes, and you know, actually performing them to audiences. I think that also has a kind of feedback quality that I miss. And I love podcasts, but I miss that in them. I miss the human interaction in them, even if it's a silent interaction of an audience. And I think what you get, you know, in these novels is cultures, both of the kinds of cultures that are intensely personally interactive, that don't have any other kind of mediation, that you know, you don't even send anybody a letter if you want to contact them. You have to walk to their house, you know, so that there's always a world of utterly intense personal interaction, which brings to the forefront these ideas of compassion and understanding and dealing with hatreds and arguments in a way that when you're mediated by anonymity, on an electronic platform, you don't have.
Exactly. So let's talk about taking this. Your novels are set in prehistoric times or Neolithic times.
They're all prehistoric,
And in old Europe. And the invasion of this other culture, this patriarchal culture. Let's just kind of take like a bird's eye view, let's say, if we could possibly, of where we are today. So bringing the principles or the ideas that you have in your novels to this day and time, what would you have to say about where we are right now?
Well, one reason I got interested in this is I think it was the great wrong turning of Western culture. I think it was a place where Western culture turned away from the earth and turned away from the earth as something, a sacred trust, and at the same time became a culture of where earth is really real estate. It's about, you know, expansion and conquest. And Western culture, of course, became world culture for various reasons, certainly has for a while. Whether it'll continue, that's another question. I believe the same men on horseback, the same cultural thing happened to the New World, where the horse was reintroduced by the conquistadors. 125 men go into Mexico and, basically pit people against one another and have a conquest. So I think that what these novels show us is that there are other ways to look at the earth, and there's other ways to look at human relationships, and that these things actually did exist, and that, you know, human beings are not necessarily predatory, they're not necessarily individualistic, they're not necessarily innately warlike, that they have a wide range of possibilities, and that for about 10,000 years, there was a different emphasis and a different choice of possibilities that was much more oriented toward preserving and taking care of the earth, and much more oriented toward the weaker of society being supported. And, you know, this is not an ideal utopia. I'm sure there were murders. I'm sure there all sorts of things happened, but there was a much less aggressive society. If you look at the California Indians, you find a somewhat similar thing. 5,000 years of small villages, minor warfare, where when somebody got hurt, pretty much everybody ran home. You find a similar existence. So it's a very viable human pattern that I think we can learn from.
So you're saying here's an example, an alternative to how we have been living for the last 5,000 years, so
yes,
to speak.
Yes, exactly.
So here's an alternative. We were not always warlike.
No.
I'm struck by the example you give, and you mentioned this earlier in the program, and I want you to describe it more thoroughly, because you have in some of your writings and conversations. It's about the ceramics that did survive from these Neolithic mm-hmm. times. And the ceramics that you find in these older cultures were very, very fine. Can you describe what they were like? You've seen these in
museums.
Oh, yes,
I have. Yes, I went to museums in Romania and Bulgaria and all. I actually visited all the places in these novels, and I looked at ceramics from these periods. Well, first of all, let me say that I thought originally that Neolithic Europe was people in caves with axes. I just had no idea that they had this. I mean, they had trade. They had sailboats, limited sailing. They had weaving, beautiful weaving. There's some parts of it have been preserved. They actually had artistic ability. These ceramics, the most beautiful of them, have these almost cosmic swirls in them. They're brown and white very often, and they have these swirling patterns and these decorations. They somewhat look like American Indian pottery. Sometimes they have chevrons on them, they have spirals, all of which have, it's been argued, are religious symbols for infinity, for death and rebirth. And in the temples, you find the kilns to make these things. So both bread baking and pottery and weaving take place in temples as well as elsewhere. So that everything, it's almost as if they didn't make things for use without making them beautiful, that all work had a religious component to it. Now,
have a potter's wheel or something, did
they? No, they didn't. They did it by hand. I don't think they had potter's wheels. I can't remember if they might have in some part of the far eastern parts, but mostly they were handmade pottery. And they're beautiful.
But with great precision.
Great precision, with a steady hand. I often wondered if they chanted when they did it, often to steady themselves. I often wondered if they meditated. I'm just speculating again. I wondered if they did, because they have such perfection of form to them. I've posted some photographs on this, and they're really astoundingly beautiful.
Now you describe how you move in. You're in the museum and you're seeing these beautiful, delicate, artistic pieces. And you move into another room, and now you're seeing the pottery and the artifacts from this other culture
from the nomadic culture,
from the nomadic, from the steppes. This this patriarchal,
which is generally called the Kurgan culture.
The Kurgan culture, and now what are their artifacts?
Well, I don't, you know, like? I have not seen broader range of them, but the ones I have seen are undecorated, plain pottery, very practical stuff that, you know, you could carry along with you. They have hooks that you could, like, tie them on a saddle, you know, over a saddle, like saddlebags, or hang them from the top of a tent. They're undecorated. They don't seem to have religious symbolism on them. If they do have anything on them, it's sun signs. They'd sometimes do circles with rays coming out because they were sun worshippers and sky worshippers. What you also find is a fantastic technology for weapons of war, things that can kill people from a horse, knives, blades. They're highly decorated. Spears from horses. They're highly decorated and chased with silver and gold, showing their value, and gold being a sign of the sun in them. And so you're seeing all the artistic and craft talent going into the weapons and not going into the artifacts of daily life.
So that can be compared to these days, how much we spend, let's say here in the U.S., how much of our national treasure is spent on weaponry.
Yes, I think that's a very good analogy.
So if we look at where we are now, going back to that bird's eye view of where we are right now, do you feel that we're at a possible turning point? Here we are. There are people who are saying there is no such thing as climate change. And then those people who are saying, my backyard is flooded right now, whatever. So there's this going on right now.
I think
now.
We're at a very crucial cultural point. I'm not a prophet. I wish I had the books. But all I can do as a writer is to present the possibilities of some alternatives that will not lead us to destruction. And I think that's the best thing an artist can do. What we can't dream, we can't do. What we can't imagine, we can't see. And what I want to do is help people imagine and see a world that is not a world of conflict, a world that is not a world of destruction and warfare, a world in which people can live in more harmony with one another, in which no gender or race or ethnicity or religion is oppressed. Now, I realize that's very idealistic, but the alternative is to accept that there's no possibility of it. And I simply refuse to accept that.
However, if we are to mimic something that we have a mentor, we have a mentor. We have a 3 billion year old mentor.
We do.
And that's Mother Earth.
Yes.
And she has survived with great resilience. And it hasn't been from a monolithic, top-down sort of culture that has caused her, whatever, I'm giving it a female kind of idea, but caused Earth to survive for this period of time, has been a great diversity.
Earth will outlast us.
Yeah. So let's talk more about that possibly in just one moment. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. Mary Mackey. She's the author of the Earth Song series of books, and as well as many other novels, and the last of which is The Village of Bones. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Dr. Mary Mackey, and she's a novelist, a poet, and her most recent book is The Village of Bones, which is a prequel to the Earth Song series of three books, the first of which is The Year the Horses Came. And Mary, in your career of many decades of writing and publishing, you've seen a lot of changes in publishing. And you talk about women in publishing. And I want to say, I want to tell a little bit of a story on New Dimensions about publishing and women. Because when we first were producing programs, going back to the 1970s, mm-hmm. we would get different publishers would approach us and say, oh, here, please do an interview on this person or this person. Mm-hmm. And most always, they were men. Mm-hmm. And at some point in the late 70s, we made the conscious decision that we were going to do at least half programming with women and even add people of color into the programming lineup. Mm-hmm. And so a publisher would call us and we'd say, well, I'm sorry, this guy sounds just great, but we're looking for women. And at that time, Michael had a side job, Michael Toms, who was mm-hmm. my co-producer and co-founder of New Dimensions. He had a job working for Harper San Francisco. And he found how publishing works. And they would have these grand meetings where everybody would meet, all the editors and the marketing people and the whole crew. And they would talk about what they're going to publish next. And it turned out that the marketing crew had a great deal of influence on what gets published. And I feel that New Dimensions had a little bit to do with the turnaround of at least part, you know, that we were part of it mm-hmm. to turn around to have more women published in, at least in the U.S., where they would say, well, you know, we need more women because we can't market this book. We need more women. And we noticed that in the late 70s and early 80s, we had more choices of women authors or women people speaking out.
Well, thank you, because Harper San Francisco published the first book in this series, The Year the Horses Came, and I hope you had something to do with it. So I'm indebted to you. I have a funny story about this, and this was not Harper San Francisco. I'm going to leave anonymous who it is. But after I had a series of books published, and then I came back with some more books, and they said to my agent, a publisher, ultimately this book was published. It did quite well. In fact, it became a bestseller, but that's another story. But they came to the publisher, and the publisher said, oh, we're not looking for books by women this year. Women have peaked. I loved it. It's like, okay, cat videos, we're not interested in them anymore. And I always thought that was hilarious. You know, and this was the early 80s, and I thought, women have peaked, have they? Hang on, buddy. Women have not peaked, you know. But it was, I thought that was one of my interesting encounters with publishing. When I first was published, there were very few women who were getting published for anything but domestic fiction and romance. And I was very lucky. I had an excellent agent, Barbara Lowenstein, who's still my agent, really good agent. And Doubleday took my first novel, which was a comic novel about McCarthyism, actually, called McCarthy's List, written what I called in the first person insane, because it's the only way you could approach the subject. And so I became published. And at that point, it became easier for me. And I was published, you know, frequently. And I had a New York Times bestseller. I had some San Francisco bestsellers. And, you know, I got sent on book tours, and it was, you know, they'd send you to hotels and they'd send a person along with you to get you sandwiches, you know, and it was you kind of got to be a little bit of a rock star.
Very different times.
Now, I feel very strongly that young writers are in a very difficult situation now, because that's no longer happening. They're no longer getting the support, and they're no longer getting the publicity. No matter how famous you are now, they expect you to do your own publicity. I know a writer who has a mystery series. I'm not going to name him. I'm just going to say he has a mystery series that is extremely famous. He has sold many, many, many books. He has to hire people to do tweeting for him. Okay?
Yeah.
He has to hire other people to do it. So you can only do that if you've already made some money, if you have a day job, if you have resources. My day job was I was a professor. I always had a little dental insurance, you know. I always had a day job. I loved teaching, and I was able to support my writing. I never had to live from it, but people trying to live from it now, it's not easy.
It's not easy. And I noticed that because I get books all the time in my mm-hmm. capacity of hosting this program, and have for years. And I noticed years ago when I would get something that was, let's say, self-published.
Yeah.
It was hard to look at. It was hard to read. The way that the whole thing was set up, just graphically, it was just not good. Nowadays, that is not the case. That if it's something from Amazon Publishing or iUniverse or whatever it is, it might be self-published from a very small press that is actually a self-published book. It graphically looks the same as if it's from a big publisher. You can't tell the difference, and it's been well edited, and not in every case, but it doesn't stop me, in other words, just because it's self-published. It doesn't stop me from looking at it in these days.
Yeah, I think the problem is volume of work. I mean, and some people can write, and some people need to work harder and do more drafts. I wrote 5 novels before I got one published. So I learned my craft by making mistakes. And I think the ease of self-publishing allows people to publish things that later they will realize were not as polished as they would have wished.
Right, exactly. So what you're saying is enjoy the rewrites.
I love rewriting. Yeah.
You do.
Oh, I do.
Give us some advice on rewriting.
Oh, okay. I always say a novel's not written, it's rewritten. You know, once you get it down there, then you can do all sorts of fun things to it. You can change it around. I mean, I go to the perfect comma. Flaubert is one of my idols, and his great quote is, this morning I put in a comma, this afternoon I took it out. You know, so I look at the punctuation, I look at the commas, I build the characters more, I put in more detail. I spend a lot of time polishing my work, and I absolutely love it. It's my form of meditation. It centers me. It gives me joy. It makes me very happy, and I could do it forever.
I think that I've heard that when you have a character in one of your novels, you will ask that character 50 questions.
Yes, over 50, like 70. Yeah.
70 questions. So, what kinds of questions would you ask to know that
character? Well, what I try to do is, and this is just a game I play with myself, of course, is I sit and I close my eyes and I try to visualize the character. I'm a very visual person. I try to, let's say it's one of my female characters. I sit her down in front of me and I say, what was your childhood like? You know, did you have any traumas? Did you like your parents? What was your favorite toy? What colors do you like best? What lovers have you had? What did you like about them? What's your favorite reading material? I mean, this is assuming it's not Neolithic. And I just ask, I have a series of questions I've developed that I ask. And those characters, then I come, open my eyes and I write down the answers, or I might even keep my eyes open and write them. And by the time I've answered all those, I know them as well as I would know a best friend or sister. And I know them very well. And then when I make them come alive on the page, I don't use all that information, but I know who they are and I know what they'll do and I know the limits of what they can do. And if they can't do what I want them to do, I have to go back and either change their character or I have to change what I want them to do. Because once you've created a person, it's not like a puppet. You can't just make it do whatever you want. That the whole being of the character informs what they're capable of doing.
That's very interesting. I think that Alice Walker has talked about that that then they start to inhabit you. I mean,
they do, and then they take off on their own if you're not careful.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. So that just reminds me, you don't plan out your novels to the nth degree.
I do, but then I abandon the plan. That's the secret. I like to know where I'm going, and it's very important to have some idea of where you're going. So, and also, I have sold novels in what's called partial. I've sold novels on one-page summaries. Once you have a very good track record, you can sometimes do this. I think it's much harder now. So I will write a two-page summary of the plot. And send it to my agent to see if she's interested in me, pursuing it and going on with it, because I like to get feedback from her. Then I sometimes have written slightly longer outlines. But the most important thing about an outline is to be able to abandon it. That the joy of writing is discovery. I once, my novel, The Grand Passion, which is about 3 generations of women involved in ballet, which was a New York Times bestseller, I had written 350 pages of another novel that wasn't working. And only one chapter was was working. And it was a chapter about a woman who went to her sister's ballet performance at Lincoln Center. And that was a beautiful chapter, and everything else wasn't alive. And I was standing in the shower, where I get many of my best ideas because of the sound of water on my head is sort of soothing. And I thought, that's the end of the novel I should be writing. And I went into my study and I outlined a new novel called A Grand Passion about three generations of women involved in ballet. And that was the novel I wrote. And that was my New York Times best-selling novel. It sold millions of copies, you know, a million copies. So, fabulous. You know, that was just, you know, being able to abandon it, being able to see this is wrong, but this one chapter, a year and a half of work, only one chapter worked, and then it blossomed.
And then to be willing to just throw the other out and go for it.
You have to see what's working, you know. Yeah, it's very hard, but you have to say it's not the work I put into it, it's how well it works for the reader.
There you go.
I'm not writing for me, I'm writing for you.
Right. But you're writing for you, too.
I'm writing for me, too, because that pleases me.
You feel the energy.
Yeah. You feel the energy.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Mary, we could just talk about writing all day, I think. And I know it's a very interesting subject for many of us. I want to thank you so much for being part of New Dimensions today.
Well, thank you for inviting me here. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you. I have, too. I've been speaking with Dr. Mary Mackey, and she's the author of many books, as you've just heard, and the most recent is The Village of Bones, Savala's Tale, and it's a prequel to the Earth Song series of three books, the first of which is The Year the Horses Came. If you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, marymackey.com, and she spells her last name M-A-C-K-E-Y, marymackey.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3607.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org. And just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Rizwan Virk, author of The Simulation Hypothesis. Next time on New Dimensions...
The Bill Reed Gallery presents Bright Futures, an exhibition that brings together the innovative art of Bill Reid with new works by contemporary emerging and established indigenous artists of the Northwest Coast, until January 14th, 2024. To celebrate the life of Bill Reid 25 years after his death, contributing artists were invited to ponder and critique the question, how is Bill Reid continuously inspiring contemporary Northwest Coast artists? To learn more about this exhibition, visit billreidgallery.ca.
You're listening.